While the high court's ruling might not have been a total shock, the vote certainly was. The justices voted unanimously to allow a religious test in taxpayer-funded foster care services in the case of Fulton versus Philadelphia. We're fortunate, very fortunate, to have one of the nation's leading legal scholars with us to discuss the details. Dahlia Lithwick is a widely read journalist, author, and the host of the popular Amicus podcast. Dahlia, thanks for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me back. It's always a pleasure.
Briefly, what was the Fulton case?
So the Fulton case essentially arises because Catholic Social Services, which is a licensing agency in Philadelphia that licenses families to provide foster care, was not prepared to license families if they had same-sex parents. They felt as though it violated their religious convictions and beliefs. The city of Philadelphia said, that's fine. You can have your religious beliefs. We can't send foster care placement requests to Catholic Social Services. That would violate the public accommodations and civil rights laws of the city. Catholic Social Services sued, and they said that Philadelphia's actions in refusing to send them placements violated their religious liberty under the First Amendment. And what they said was, we need to be exempted from those civil rights laws because our First Amendment rights, in some sense, trump. And the case was very, very much watched as a kind of follow-on to Masterpiece Cake Shop, right? That was the case that came out after Obergefell, when the Supreme Court said there's a right to same-sex marriage. And in Masterpiece Cake Shop, we had a cake baker in Colorado who said, I cannot make a cake, a wedding cake for a same-sex couple. That violates my religious dignity and my religious beliefs. And famously, that was a different court. Anthony Kennedy, writing for the court, issued a very, very narrow decision, essentially saying, we're not going to make a big decision about this big question of religious freedom on one hand, civil rights law on the other. We're just going to say, in this particular instance, we think that Colorado discriminated against this baker. This was supposed to be the case, Fulton, that actually resolved that one way or another, put a thumb heavily on the scale, either for the, you know, desire of the religious entity to be accommodated, or for civil rights laws not to have exemptions for religious believers. In a sense, the court whiffed. We had, as you said, a 9-0, very narrow decision. It feels a lot like Masterpiece Cake Shop. The court said, in this instance, the city of Philadelphia did discriminate against Catholic Social Services, but the court didn't go further and do a big dramatic thing, whether that was overrule, like Smith versus Employment Division, that's the case that's supposed to control, or make some big pronouncement in all cases, First Amendment religious rights will be privileged. We just have, in some sense, more uncertainty, but yet again, a thumb on the scale, it seems, for religious entities to be exempted.
So how significant is the fact that the decision was unanimous?
Well, you know, that becomes a really interesting question about the tactical and, I think I need to say, sort of utter strategic brilliance of Chief Justice John Roberts, that this is a case if you look at some of the COVID cases that the court decided earlier this year, where we had religious entities that wanted to be exempted from shutdown orders, you could see how ugly and fractious those opinions were. On the one side, you had, you know, Justice Kavanaugh, Justice Alito, just enraged that a city could keep a bike shop open but close a church. On the other hand, you had Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Sonia Sotomayor, writing these furious, furious dissents in those cases, saying, you know, people are going to die if you open churches. This is the, you know, court quite literally playing God with people's lives. All of that is gone in this case. I mean, there's some outrage. Justice Sam Alito writes a concurrence that's not really a concurrence. He's very angry that the big, big issues don't get resolved. But it is a masterful thing to get the entire court to sign off on an issue that, I think you implied this in your opening, really is the biggest civil rights issue, I think, of this moment, the collision between religious liberty on the one hand and civil rights of disadvantaged groups on the other, to get it to a point where the court all shrugs and says, eh, you know, was a little bit bad. Philadelphia, you shouldn't probably do that, but we're not doing anything big today. That's an extraordinary tactical move.
So for whom was this ruling a victory?
Well, in the hours after Fulton came down, it was clear that both sides were issuing statements saying it was a victory. And I think in some sense that was because while nominally Catholic Social Services won, and I think that the goalposts were moved in a way that will make it easier for religious dissenters to win in future, we also really heard from an awful lot of progressive groups that were afraid the sky was going to fall, that this was going to be a ruling that declared open season on LGBTQ Americans, and also I think that opened the door for race discrimination and gender discrimination under cover of saying this is religious liberty. That didn't happen. The fact that you had the three liberal justices, Stephen Breyer, Elena Kagan, Sonia Sotomayor, all sign off on this opinion tells you that that didn't happen, at least not this week. And so I think in a very strange sense, both sides got to come away saying they won. Neither side got everything they wanted. It feels as though, in some sense, the court kicked this can down the road to decide another day. And as I said, if you are a disadvantaged minority in America who has used civil rights law to protect you, as we've seen since the 1960s, when those public accommodations laws really were created to help people, I think, who felt that the political process didn't protect him, the courts had to. I think you're a little nervous today. I think that this opens the door. And in fact, I think the court almost explicitly invites the next round of challenges and challenges to Employment Division, which is the 1990 case that ostensibly set a boundary to how much religious freedom claims could trump the laws. And I think that the court has yet again said, and Amy Coney Barrett, writing for herself, said, I'm not completely sure I want to overturn Employment Division today. I'm not sure what rises up in its place, but I'm interested. I'm thinking about it. That's not a good sign, I think, if you are afraid that religious dissenters are going to swallow the entire civil rights regime.
Would you talk about the shadow docket and what that means in light of the ruling in Fulton, Philadelphia?
The shadow docket is a term of art that wonky Supreme Court watchers like me have been writing and thinking about for the last few years. And I think Professor Will Bowd introduced the term. Steve Vladek at Texas writes about it regularly. This year, there were congressional hearings about it. It sounds sinister. I guess it could be sinister. But the notion of the shadow docket is that the presumption for Supreme Court cases is that they percolate through the lower courts. They go through a district court, an appeals court. There is extensive briefing. Amicus briefs are filed. The cases are argued at the court. And that at the end of that, the court hands down a reasoned public decision on the merits. The shadow docket is the term that has been used for cases that have come down increasingly with great frequency in the last few years, where that whole process is stymied, that somebody seeks an injunction, the case rockets up to the Supreme Court, and sometimes it's neither argued nor briefed. The court just kind of pulls out a back of the envelope and writes a couple of paragraphs, issues an order in the dark of night sometimes, and that becomes the law. And we see that has happened. It's really emerged in some death penalty cases in recent years, but it's also emerged in, and I mentioned this at the top, some of these COVID religious liberty cases. So these are cases that arise when churches or synagogues want to be exempted from the general shutdown orders, particularly in California and New York. We had major cases on this. And instead of going through the process of having the whole thing litigated over years in the courts, these very preliminary rulings would go rocket to the moon to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court would sign an order making new law. And yet sometimes we actually didn't even know which justices were in the majority because their names are not on it. We don't know who authored it. We don't know – because it was not argued or briefed, we don't know the merits. We just know the rules have changed. And so the shadow docket is the name of this umbrella of cases that come down, as I said, often Friday afternoon at 8 o'clock at night, you know, very late in the day. The law has changed, the goalposts has moved, but nobody quite knows why or how. And those COVID cases, notably the two big ones in California and New York, made it clear that the law of religious liberty was changing, that there was, again, the term of art is most favored nation status, that religious groups could say, hey, if a bicycle shop is allowed to be open, if a casino is allowed to be open, if a nail salon is allowed to be open in COVID, we get that too. And that is not the law of the land. That's not the law of employment division. But that became the law of the shadow docket in those COVID cases. And what the concern was, is because that happened in a way that was imperceptible, unless you were really, really watching court orders coming down on the weekends, that set the tone for how Fulton came down. That it looks as though what Fulton was is reliant on that idea that if exemptions are given to anyone for any reason, if the city of Philadelphia has the right to say we have discretion about placements, then that has to be granted mandatorily to religious dissenters. That is something that may have happened in the shadows in the COVID cases. It really came into the light, I think, in Fulton.
I have to say, I scratch my head about this. And how do you interpret the trend of these narrowly tailored rulings that seem designated to avoid, just as you've said, setting precedents? I thought that was a core part of the high court's job.
You are exactly right. And the concern that I have and that I share with you is that if you are going to do this, if you are going to make new law of religious liberty, do it in the open. Do it in hundreds of pages of written opinions, and do it with all parties having briefed the issues and made their best case. But what you get, and this was the real concern that I had, in the COVID cases, and it really, I think, materially leans into Fulton, is that when you have the justices making claims or even parties making claims, as we heard in COVID, this was animus. The governor hates religious people. The governor hates churches, and this was done out of animus towards religious groups. That's not shown. It's not proved. That becomes baked into the doctrine. The doctrine now seems to have this idea that state public health officials who are making law in COVID, trying, I think, doing their best wrongly somehow to create a system of laws that protected life, started from the proposition that they hate religion. And not only that, I think that's bad enough that you're seeing that in a lot of the opinions, but then there's this other piece of it that I'm equally worried about, which is these third-party harms, that people are harmed, that people who clean churches, that sweep the floors, that work there, who may not share the religious views and values of the institution, are at risk of catching COVID, not to mention ambulance drivers and hospital workers. And the idea that all of that disappears because the court is doing, as you say, not just that it's not transparent about the rulings of the case and the doctrine, but not also just not taking into account all the things that courts need to take into account, and that becomes a part of the doctrine. And so my concern in those COVID shadow docket cases was, as you say, that the court was not open about what it was doing. And that's the one thing the court has to do in a democracy, is be open about the moves it's making, but also just writing off harms to other people. It's as though those people are invisible to the courts. And I really was aware in Fulton that the one thing Anthony Kennedy did in Masterpiece Cake Shop, when he wrote the opinion about that cake baker, was solicitude, deep solicitude for married same-sex couples and their dignitary interests. In Fulton, that's gone. It evaporates from the case. Chief Justice Roberts scoops up a little bit of Kennedy's language from Masterpiece Cake Shop and really, I think, overrides or ignores the dignitary interests of same-sex couples in this case that just want to be foster parents and want to be seen. And so one of the things, you know, as you know, that is worrisome is not just that the court isn't publicly, openly, within the four corners of the opinion, analyzing all the factors, but that it seems to be willing to just elide or ignore actual harms that come about that are at least supposed to be part of their balancing.
Now, yeah, I get nervous, more than nervous, when anybody says we're going to change the law about religious freedom. We have a First Amendment that people are attacking all the time. We have groups in the religious right that are working day and night to redefine what religious freedom is. And when the court says, we're going to change this, I get really worried. Can you tell me anything good about that?
I'm not sure I can, because I share your view that something profound is shifting, that these religious liberty claims are ascendant, that between Hobby Lobby and the Little Sisters cases, Masterpiece Cake Shop in 2018, and Fulton, those religious freedom claims are going to keep winning. And I think you're right to say that as they keep winning, what gets shoved aside is all the other interests. We have, rightly or wrongly, for the two centuries of, you know, wrangling over the First Amendment and the religious interests and liberties and the two slightly clashing religious clauses in the First Amendment, they've accommodated each other. They've rubbed along. And whether that happened correctly or not, whether the holding in Employment Division that had laid out, written, by the way, by Justice Antonin Scalia, that had laid out that not every religious objector can get their way if it's a neutral law of general applicability. That was supposed to be the rule. That seems to be cratering, that whole equilibrium of trying to, as best as possible, accommodate religious dissenters, accommodate religious liberty, but also understand that the law is the law and it has to apply to people, and that we cannot carve out exemptions for everybody who feels burdened. So I think you're right that that balance has radically shifted in the last few years. I think it is clear to me that there are five, maybe six votes on this current court that will continue to shift that balance in favor of privileging religious liberty. But I think the thing you and I are both saying implicitly here is that the fact that it's happening either in the shadow docket, in unsigned orders, the fact that it's happening between the black letter law in Fulton is also of concern. In other words, you can't effectively overrule employment division without overruling it. You can't change this without saying you're changing it. And I think what's worrying is not just that the balance is being recalibrated, but it's happening in a way that feels like it's not perfectly open.
Are you more concerned in how this court is approaching religious freedom issues or the way it's approaching the fundamental question of legal rulings itself, particularly in matters of exception versus discretion?
I think, can I say both? I think I'm concerned about both of them. I'm concerned almost more than anything about a third characteristic, which is that a sense of personal religious grievance on the part of the justices has started to leach into not just the opinions. As I said, I was really struck by the ways in which, particularly in some of the COVID cases, you had a sense that some of the justices were coming at this from a sense that decision makers, lawmakers hate religious people and want to punish them. And that has leached into the way Sam Alito gives speeches. It has leached into the way Justice Thomas writes. So I think part of what I'm worried about isn't simply, you know, as you ask it, that the calibration of religious liberty is changing. That's clearly happening. Or that how it's happening with these slightly pretextual, you know, this was a really deft move by Chief Justice Roberts to say, because there is discretion in the entities that place and license foster parents, discretion that's in the best interest of the child, so that a decision maker can say, I don't feel good about this household. He turns that into an exemption. And now it looks like we've got a framework of religious exemptions. That's a neat trick. But all of that notwithstanding, you know, some of the what feels like playing fast and loose with the rules, I think the thing that worries me most is this almost over-identification with the idea that we are in a religious war in America and that there are these unwashed, secular, nasty haters who are coming to take away religious freedom. That's a conversation, whether you and I agree with it or not, that can play out in the political discourse. That, I guess, is where it should play out. And it certainly is playing out at this moment. But when that starts to get braided into opinion writing and you have this sense, this very, very angry, visceral sense that is starting to inflect in how the justices themselves think about this quote-unquote culture war that we're in, that almost scares me more than anything, because it opens the door, as I said, not just for devaluing and disregarding who is hurt in that conversation, and whether it's racial minorities or LGBTQ Americans or women or the elderly whose interests are being subsumed by religious liberty claims, it allows the court to operate from a place of grievance, personal grievance, that I think is just really dangerous, whatever context it comes out in. And I don't think it helps the court do the dispassionate work of this incredibly hard, let's be clear, calculus of, you know, civil rights, civil liberty, and religious freedom. That's a really hard balance to draw. And it is a balance that the framers baked into the First Amendment religion clauses. But to come at it from a place that the other side are haters and they're in a culture war and they want to trash you and your values, and when that gets imported into how the justice is right, that more than almost anything is what you're hearing me worry about.
I've got to just ask you, if there's something you can say about this court that might be comforting, this would be a good time for you to say it.
I think the comforting thing I would say, and I would commend your listeners to read Adam Liptak, had a really good piece in the New York Times after Fulton came down, where he talked about, and I think this is important, when Amy Coney Barrett came on the court, I think there was a real fear that you were going to see a 6-3 juggernaut. That gun rights were going to be enshrined and expanded, reproductive care was going to end, the administrative state was going to be kneecapped, you know, that this was Armageddon, the beginning of the end. Whatever happened this year, it wasn't that. Whatever happened this year was overwhelmingly a big bump at the middle of the court where, improbably enough, Chief Justice John Roberts, who has been the center fulcrum of a 4-4 court since Anthony Kennedy left, has really managed to bring in Justices Breyer and Kagan on the left overwhelmingly, and improbably the Trump justices, Amy Coney Barrett and Kavanaugh. Justice Kavanaugh has been at that center bump. The people who are angriest on the John Roberts court in 2021 are Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas, who are not getting the very, very, very conservative outcomes, particularly, by the way, in this space that you and I are describing, religious freedom. And so I think that to the extent that you can find comfort in the fact that the court has 5, maybe 6, Justice Gorsuch sometimes is in that moderate bump I'm describing at the center. Justice Sotomayor was certainly joined in Fulton. If you can find a court that has coalesced around John Roberts' idea that, you know, the cynical version is we're going to do this over 10 years instead of over 1 year. That's the cynical version, and I worry about that. The less cynical version is that this moderate center of the court, or whatever it is, has coalesced around the idea that we do things small and we do them incrementally, and that we don't lord over, you know, the world, our Article III imperviousness, that we are careful what public opinion thinks. And what I saw this year and what I take comfort from, and I hope your listeners can take comfort from, is given the opportunity to be a 6-3 supermajority juggernaut, the court time and time and time again did not do that. And what that means next term, when abortion is on the docket and gun rights are on the docket and probably affirmative action is on the docket, next term is going to be, we're going to put that notion to the test, because the court could, in fact, in broad, broad, broad strokes, really end decades worth of progressive accomplishments in America. And it will be, by the way, on this question, I think, of religious liberty and civil rights, that we see it happen quickly. But I do think that there appears to be a sensitivity at the court that the American public is watching more closely than ever, that Joe Biden has this commission that's talking about serious structural court reform, that Americans are very angry about how Amy Coney Barrett replaced Justice Ginsburg, and Mitch McConnell threatening to never seat a Biden justice if he gets control of the Senate. I think we're doing the right thing by watching. I think conversations like the one you and I are having that suggests that what the court does is not magic. It can't happen at night. I think that they can form some of their strongest impulses to moderate that because we're watching. And I don't think that's entirely a tragic story.
Nadia Lithwick is senior editor at Slate Magazine and contributing editor for Newsweek. She's the host of the Slate Amicus podcast, available wherever fine podcasts are served. It is because of what you do and how clearly you do it today. This has been immensely helpful, and I thank you so much for taking this much time to be with us on State of Belief Radio, and I hope we can do it again.
I really, truly love being with you. I'm so grateful for your kind words, and I really, you know, not only do I thank you for your work, but I really want listeners to understand that the court, in some sense, works for us, works for democracy. It's not magic. It's not an oracle in the sky. And that this work that you and I are trying to do of paying attention and really centering what the court does with freedom and dignity, I think it's never been more important than it is right now. So thank you for having me.